వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సమప్రభ నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా. శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి. అత స్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Om Shri Sai Ram. My most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning, greetings and loving Sai Ram from Prashanthinilayam. And with me, Team Radio Sai, Sunil, welcoming you to this morning segment, Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashanthinilayam. Today is the 21st of November 2019. And here in Prashanthinilayam, the 94th Jayanti celebrations of our beloved Bhagwan is in full swing. And you can catch the celebrations live on Radio Sai's YouTube channel, both morning and in the evening. Let me now read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. What is Bhagwan's expectation of every volunteer, office bearer and member in the Sai organization? Bhagwan lovingly reminds us today, and I quote, "Treat everyone as your brother and sister. There may be differences of opinion and at times, but that should not lead to hatred and enmity. Differences should not divide us. Members of the Sai organization should foster such unity. Let there not be any conflicts. Live like children of the same family. Get a good name so that there is no other organization comparable to the Sai organization in the world. Develop love and work unitedly. Only when the five fingers of the hand come together can any task be accomplished. One may be the president of the organization. That does not mean that one can act according to one's whims and fancies. I am aware of the fact that there are no such people in the Sai organization. Yet, I am cautioning you. All the wings of the Sai organization, Samiti, Sevadal, Balvikas, etc., should work in harmony. Consider different wings as the fingers of the same hand and work unitedly." Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on November 20th, 1998. Dear listener, the time right now in our studios is 17 minutes past 10 a.m. that is Indian Standard Time, and today in Divine Glory I've lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book Sri Sai Satcharitra by Hema Pant, followed by a Tryst with Divinity conversation with Mr. Ryuko Hira of Japan, a long-standing devotee of Bhagwan Baba. First, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hema Pant. We are thankful to Vasanti Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. And here it is for your listening pleasure.
The Ramdasi returns soon with the Senna pods. Anna Chichanikar, who was then present and wanted to play the part of Narad, who was also well known for setting up confrontations between gods and demons, informed him of what had happened. The Ramdasi at once flared up. He came down at once on Shama with full fury. He said it was Shama who said Baba to send him away under the pretext of stomachache for bringing the medicine, and thus took away the book. He began to scold and abuse Shama and remarked that if the book was not returned, he would dash his head. Shama calmly remonstrated with him, but in vain. Then Baba spoke kindly to him as follows. O Ramdasi, what is the matter with you? Why are you so turbulent? Is not Shama our boy? Why do you scold him unnecessarily? How is it that you are so quarrelsome? Can you not speak soft and tender words? You read these sacred books daily and still your mind is agitated and your passions uncontrolled. What sort of a Ramdasi are you? You ought to be indifferent to all things. Is it not strange that you should possess this book so strongly? A true Ramdasi should have no mamta, but have samta towards all. You are now quarrelling with Shama for a mere book? Go, take a seat. Books can be had in plenty with money, but not men. Think well and be considerate. What worth is your book? Shama had no concern with it. I took it myself and gave it to him. You know it by heart. I thought Shama might read it and benefit from it, so I gave it to him. How sweet were these words of Baba, soft, tender and nectar-like. Their effect was wonderful. The Ramdasi calmed down and said to Shama that he would take Panchratni Gita in return. Shama was much pleased and said, "Why one? I shall give you 10 copies in return." So the matter was ultimately settled. The question for consideration is, why should the Ramdasi press for Panchratni Gita, a book for which he never cared to know? And why should he, who daily read religious books in the masjid in front of Baba, quarrel with Shama before him? We do not know how to apportion the blame and whom to blame. We only say that, had this incident not happened, the importance of the subject, the efficacy of God's name, and the significance of Vishnu Sahasranam would not have been brought home to Shama. So we see that Baba's method of teaching and initiating was unique. In this case, Shama did gradually study the book and mastered its contents to such an extent that he was able to explain it to Professor G.G. Narke of the College of Engineering, Pune, the son-in-law of Sriman Bhuti and a devotee of Baba. Vitthal Vision. One day, while Kaka Sahib Dikshit was in meditation, after his morning bath in his vada at Shirdi, he saw a vision of Vitthal. When he went to see Baba later, Baba asked him, "Did Vitthal Patil come? Did you not see him? He is very elusive. Hold him fast, otherwise he'll give you the slip and run away." Then at noon, a certain hawker came there with 20 or 25 pictures of Vitthal of Pandharpur for sale. Mr. Dikshit was surprised to see that the form of Vitthal he saw in his meditation exactly matched with that in the picture, and he was also reminded of Baba's words. He therefore bought one picture most willingly and kept it in his shrine for worship. Gita Rahasya. Baba always loved those who studied Brahma Vidya and encouraged them. To give an instance, once Papu Sahib Jog received a post parcel. It contained a copy of Gita Rahasya by Lokmanya Tilak. Taking it under his armpit, he came to the masjid and prostrated before Baba when the parcel fell at Baba's feet. Baba inquired what it was. It was opened then and there, and the book was placed in Baba's hand. He turned some pages here and there for a few minutes and took out a rupee from his pocket, placed it on the book, and handed the same with the rupee to Jog and said to him, "Read this completely and you will be benefited." Mr. and Mrs. Karpade. Let us close this chapter with a description of the Karpades. Once, Dada Sahib Karpade came with his family and lived in Shirdi for some months. Dada Sahib was not an ordinary man. He was the affluent and most famous advocate of Amravati and was a member of the Council of State in New Delhi. He was intelligent and a very good speaker. Still, he dared not open his mouth before Baba. Most devotees spoke and argued with Baba off and on, but only three, Karpade, Noorkar and Bhuti, kept always silent. They were meek, modest, humble and good-natured. Dada Sahib who was able to expound Panchadashi, a well-known Sanskrit treatise on the Advaita philosophy by the famous Vidyaranya. He uttered no word when he came to the masjid before Baba. A man, however learned he may be even in Vedas, fades away before one who has realized Brahma and becomes one with it. Learning cannot stand before self-realization. Dada Sahib stayed for 4 months, but Mrs. Karpade stayed for 7. Both were highly pleased with their Shirdi stay. Mrs. Karpade was faithful and devout and loved Baba deeply. Every noon she brought Naivedya herself to the masjid, and after it was accepted by Baba, she used to return and take her meals. On seeing her steady and firm devotion, Baba wanted to exhibit it to others. One noon, she brought a dish containing sansa or wheat pudding. She also brought puris, rice, soup and kheer and other articles to the masjid. Baba, who usually waited for hours, got up at once, went up to his seat and, removing the cover from the dish, began to partake of the things zealously. Shama then asked him, "Why this partiality? At times you throw away dishes of others and do not care to look at them, but this appeals to you earnestly. Why? Is the dish brought by this lady so sweet? This intrigues us." Baba then explained, "This food is really extraordinary. In former birth, this lady was a merchant's fat cow yielding much milk. Then she disappeared and took birth in a gardener's family and then in a Kshatriya family and married a merchant. She was born later in a Brahmin family. I saw her after a very long time. Let me take some sweet morsels of love from her dish." After saying this, Baba did full justice to her dish, washed his mouth and hands and belched out as if he was fully satisfied. He then resumed his seat. Then she bowed down and began to shampoo Baba's legs, and he began to talk with her and knead her arms, which were shampooing his legs. On seeing this reciprocal service, Shama began to joke and said, "Ah, it is going on well, a wonderful sight to see God and his bhaktas serving each other." After being pleased with her sincere service, Baba asked her in low and fascinating tone to chant Raja Ram, Raja Ram, always, and said, "If you do this, your life's object will be achieved. Your mind will attain peace, and you will be immensely benefited." To persons unfamiliar with spiritual matters, this might appear as a polite gesture, but really it was not so. It was a case of what is technically called Shaktipat, that is, transference of power from the guru to the disciple. How effective were Baba's words? In an instant they pierced her heart and remained there. This case illustrates the nature of the relations that should subsist between the guru and the disciple. Both should love and serve each other as one. There is no distinction nor any difference between them. Both are one, and one cannot live without the other. The disciple placing his hand at the guru's feet is a gross or outward vision. Really and internally, they are both one and the same. Those who see any difference between them are yet unripe and not perfect. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 28. Sparrows Driven to Shirdi. Lakshmi Chand, Barhanpur Lady, Megha. Preliminary. Sai is not finite or limited. He dwells in all beings, from ants and insects to the god Brahma. He pervades all. Sai was well versed in the knowledge of the Vedas as well as in the science of self-realization. As he was proficient in both these, he was well fitted to be the Sadguru. Anyone, though learned but not able to awaken the disciples and establish them in self-realization, does not deserve to be called a Sadguru. Generally, the worldly parents give birth to the body, but death invariably follows life. But Sadguru does away with both life and death, and so he is more kind and merciful than anybody else. Sai Baba often said that, "Let his man be at any distance, 1,000 kos away from him, he will be drawn to Shirdi like a sparrow with a thread tied to his feet." This chapter describes the stories of three such sparrows. Lala Lakshmi Chand. This gentleman was first serving in the Sri Venkateshwar Press in Mumbai, then in the Railway Department, and later in the firm of Messrs. Raleigh Brothers and Company as a Munshi. He got the contact of Baba in 1910. 1 or 2 months before Christmas, he saw in his dream at Santa Cruz an old man with a beard, standing and surrounded by his bhaktas. A few days later, he went to the house of his friend, Mr. Dattatreya Manjunath Bijur, to hear the kirtan by Das Ganu. It was, and is, always a practice of Das Ganu to keep Baba's picture in front of the audience while doing the kirtan. Lakshmi Chand was surprised to see that the features of the old man he saw in his dream tallied exactly with those in the picture, and thus he came to the conclusion that the old man he saw in his dreams was Sai Baba himself. The sight of this picture, Das Ganu's kirtan, and the life of the Saint Tukaram on which Das Ganu discoursed, all these things made a deep impression on his mind, and he decided to go to Shirdi. It is always the experience of the bhaktas that God always helps them in their search for Sadguru and other spiritual endeavors. That very night, a friend named Shankar Rao knocked at his door and asked him whether he would accompany him to Shirdi. His joy knew no bounds, and he at once decided to go to Shirdi and borrowed 15 rupees from his cousin. After making due preparations, he left for Shirdi. In the train, he and his friend Shankar Rao did some bhajan and inquired about Sai Baba with some fellow passengers who were four Muslims returning to their place near Shirdi. They all told them that Sai Baba was a great saint living in Shirdi for many years. When they reached Kopargaon, he wanted to buy some good guavas for offering to Baba, but he was so much enwrapped with the scenery and sights there that he forgot to purchase them. When they were nearing Shirdi, he was reminded of the guavas. Just then, he saw an old woman with a guava basket on her head running after the tonga. The tonga was stopped, and he gladly purchased some fruits when the woman said, "Take all the rest and offer them on my behalf to Baba." The facts that he had intended to purchase guavas but had forgotten to do so, the old woman's encounter and her devotion to Baba, all these were a pleasant surprise to both the friends, and Lakshmi Chand thought in his mind that the old woman might be some relation of the old man he saw in his dream. Then they drove on and came near Shirdi, and on seeing flags on the masjid, they saluted them. With puja materials in hand, they went to the masjid and worshipped Baba with due formality. Lakshmi Chand was much moved and was extremely happy to see Baba. He was enwrapped with Baba's feet as a bee with a sweet-smelling lotus. Then Baba spoke as follows. "Cunning fellow, he does bhajan on the way and inquiries from others. Why ask others? Everything we should see with our own eyes. Where is the necessity to question others? Just think for yourself whether your dream is true or not. Where was the necessity of the darshan by taking a loan from a Marwari? Is the heart's desire now satisfied?" Hearing these words, Lakshmi Chand was wonderstruck at Baba's omniscience. He was at a loss to know how Baba came to know about all the things that had happened en route from his house to Shirdi. The chief thing to note in this respect is that Baba never liked people to borrow or take loan for his darshan or celebrating any holiday or making any pilgrimage. Sanza. At noon, when Lakshmi Chand was sitting for meals, he got some sanza from a devotee as prasad. He was pleased to have it. Next day also he expected it, but got nothing. So he was anxious to get it again. Then on the third day at the noon aarti time, Bapu Sahib Jog asked Baba what naivedya he should bring. Baba told him to bring sanza or wheat pudding. Then the bhaktas brought 2 big potfuls of sanza. Lakshmi Chand was very hungry and there was some pain in his back. Then Baba said to him, "It is good that you are hungry. Take sanza and some medicine for the pain in the back." Lakshmi Chand was again wonderstruck to see that Baba again read his mind and spoke out what was passing in. How omniscient was he! evil eye. During this visit, Lakshmi Chand also witnessed one night the procession of the Chavadi. Baba then suffered much from cough. He thought the suffering of Baba might be due to somebody's evil eye. Next morning, when he went to the masjid, Baba spoke to Shama as follows. I suffered last night from cough. Is it due to some evil eye? I think that somebody's evil eye has worked on me and so I am suffering. In this case, Baba spoke out what was passing in Lakshmi Chand's mind. On seeing these proofs of Baba's omniscience and kindness to his bhaktas, Lakshmi Chand fell prostrate at Baba's feet and said, I am much blessed with your darshan. Ever be kind and merciful to me and protect me always. There is no God to me in this world except you. Let my mind be ever wrapped in your bhajan and feet. Let your grace protect me from the miseries of the world and let me ever chant your name and be happy. After getting Baba's udi and blessing, he returned home with his friends, much pleased and contented, and was singing Baba's glory on the way. He remained a staunch devotee of Baba later and always sent garlands of flowers, camphor and dakshina with any person of his acquaintance bound for Shirdi. Barhanpur Lady. Now, let us turn to another sparrow. One lady in Barhanpur saw in her dream Sai Baba coming to her door and begging khichdi. On waking up, she saw nobody at her door. However, she was pleased with the vision and told it to all, including her husband. He was employed in the postal department, and when he was transferred to Akola, both husband and wife, who were devout persons, decided to go to Shirdi. Then on a suitable day, they left for Shirdi, and after visiting Gomati Tirth on the way, they reached Shirdi and stayed there for 2 months. Every day they went to the masjid, performed Baba's worship and passed their time happily. The couple came to Shirdi to offer khichdi as naivedya, but for the first 14 days, somehow or the other, it could not be offered. The lady did not like this delay or tardiness. Then, on the 15th day, she came at noon to the masjid with her khichdi. There she found that Baba and the others were already sitting for meals and that the curtain was down. Nobody dared enter in when the curtain was down, but the lady could not wait. She lifted up the curtain and entered. Strange to say, Baba seemed that day hungry for khichdi and wanted it first. And when the lady came in with a dish, Baba was delighted and began to eat morsel after morsel of khichdi. On seeing the earnestness of Baba in this respect, everybody was wonderstruck, and those who heard the story of khichdi were convinced about his extraordinary love for his devotees. The third sparrow, Megha. Now let us go to the third sparrow. Megha of Viramgaon was a simple and illiterate Brahmin cook of Rav Bahadur Sate. He was a devotee of Shiva and always chanted the 5-syllabled mantra Namah Shivaya. He did not know the Sandhya nor its chief mantra, the Gayatri. Rav Bahadur Sate was interested in him, taught him the Sandhya and the Gayatri. Sate told him that Sai Baba of Shirdi was the embodied form of the god Shiva and made him start for Shirdi. At the Broach railway station, he learned that Sai Baba was a Muslim, and his simple and orthodox mind was much perturbed at the prospect of bowing down to a Muslim, and he prayed to his master not to send him there. His master, however, insisted on his going there and gave him a letter of introduction to his father-in-law, Ganesh Damodar, alias Dada Kelkar at Shirdi, to introduce him to Sai Baba. When he reached Shirdi and went to the masjid, Baba was very indignant and would not allow him to enter. Kick out the rascal, roared Baba, and then said to Megha, you are a high caste Brahmin and I am a low Muslim. You will lose your caste by coming here. Just get away. On hearing these words, Megha began to tremble. He was wondering as to how Baba had come to know what was passing in his mind. He stayed there for some days, serving Baba in his own way, but was not convinced. Then he went home, and then to Trayambak, and stayed there for a year and a half. Then again he returned to Shirdi. This time, at the intercession of Dada Kelkar, he was allowed to enter the masjid and stay in Shirdi. Sai Baba's help to Megha was not through any oral instruction. He worked upon Megha internally with the result that he was considerably changed and benefited. Then Megha began to look upon Sai Baba as an incarnation of Shiva. In order to worship Shiva, bay leaves are required, and Megha used to go miles and miles every day to bring them and worship his Shiva, which was Baba. His practice was to worship all the deities in the village and then come to the masjid, and after saluting Baba's gaddi, he worshipped Baba, and after doing some service, drank the washings of Baba's feet. Once it so happened that he came to the masjid without worshipping Khandoba, as the door of the temple was closed. Baba did not accept his worship and sent him again, saying that the door was open then. Megha went, found the door open, worshipped the deity, and then returned to Baba as usual. Ganges Bath. On one Makar Sankranti day, Megha wanted to smear the body of Baba with sandal paste and bathe him with Ganga water. Baba was first unwilling to undergo this, but at his repeated requests, he consented. Megha had to travel a distance of 8 kos to bring the sacred water from the Gomati River. He brought the water, made all preparations for the bath at noon, and asked Baba to get ready for the same. Then Baba again asked him to be spared from this bath ritual, saying that as a fakir, he had nothing to do with the Ganges water. But Megha did not listen to him. He knew that Shiva is pleased with Abhishek on that auspicious day. Baba then consented, came down and sat on a wooden board, and projecting his head said, "O Megha, do at least this favor. Head is the most important organ of the body, so pour the water over that only. It is equivalent to the whole bath." Megha said, "All right," and lifting the water pot, began to pour it on the head. But in doing so, he was much overwhelmed with love that he cried out, "Har Har Ganga," and emptied the pot on the whole body. He kept the pot aside and began to look at Baba. But to his surprise and amazement, he found that only Baba's head was drenched, while the rest of the body was quite dry. Trident and Pindi. Megha worshipped Baba at two places. In the masjid, he worshipped Baba in person, and in the wada, Baba's big picture given by Nana Sahib Chandorkar. This he did for 12 months. Then, in order to appreciate his devotion and confirm his faith, Baba gave him a vision. One morning, when Megha was lying down on his bed with eyes closed but internally awake, he saw clearly Baba's form. Baba, knowing him to be awake, threw Akshata and said, "Megha, draw a trident," and then he disappeared. Hearing Baba's words, he eagerly opened his eyes, saw no Baba there, but only rice grains spread here and there. He then went to Baba, told him about the vision, and asked permission to draw trident. Baba said, "Did you not hear my words asking you to draw trident? It was no vision but direct order. My words are always pregnant with meaning and never hollow." Megha said, "I thought you woke me up, but all the doors were closed, so I doubted and thought it to be a vision." Baba rejoined, "I require no door to enter. I have no form. I always live everywhere. As a wire puller, I carry on all the actions of the man who trusts me and merges in me." Megha returned to the wada and drew a red trident on the wall near Baba's picture. Next day, a Ramdasi Bhakt came from Pune, saluted Baba and offered him pindi. At this time, Megha also turned up there. Baba said to him, "See, Shankar has come. Protect him now." Megha was pleasantly surprised to see pindi. Also in the wada, Kaka Sahib Dikshit was standing with a towel on his head after having taken his bath and was remembering Sai when he saw a pindi before his mental vision. While he was wondering about this, Megha came and showed him the pindi presented to him by Baba. Dikshit was happy to know that this pindi exactly tallied with the one he saw a few minutes ago in his vision. In a few days after the drawing of the trident was complete, Baba installed the pindi near the big picture which Megha was worshipping. The worship of Shiva was dear to Megha, and by the drawing of the trident and the installation of the pindi, Baba confirmed his faith. After continuous service of Baba for many years, doing regular worship and aarti every noon and evening, Megha passed away in 1912. Then, Baba passed his hands over his mortal remains and said, "This was a true devotee of mine." Baba also ordered that at his own expense the funeral dinner should be given to the Brahmins, and this order was carried out by Kaka Sahib Dikshit. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Tune in to Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to Tris with Divinity, our ongoing series of interviews with individuals whose lives have been touched and transformed by Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. Today's episode of Trist is quite extraordinary for a number of reasons. Firstly, it explores a teacher-pupil relationship based on utter humility and implicit obedience. Our guest is a highly accomplished devotee who has consciously shied away from limelight. Despite his decades-long association with Baba, we don't generally come across his name when browsing through Sai literature. Unknown to most of us, the honored guest is listed amongst the most influential Indians around the globe. His professional success is too vast to capture in a few sound bites, and his commitment to philanthropy extends across continents. And yet, he deliberately prefers to keep as low a profile as possible and describes himself as a humble servant of Bhagwan Baba. Today his name is synonymous with the Sai movement in the country of his residence, namely Japan, where he has worked hard to create a robust Sai movement and love for Vedic learning. He has built the Sai organization and Sai centers from ground up and instituted scholarships to successfully promote Indian culture, Sanskrit language, and Vedas among the Japanese. And his passion and dedication to his master is not limited to Japan. Within the Sri Sathya Sai International Organization, he has served as the overseas chairman of Zone B countries across Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, covering a total of 80 countries. Dear listeners, with us in the studio today is Mr. Ryuko Hira from Tokyo, Japan. In his professional life, Mr. Hira is the chairman of the Ora Group of Companies in Japan. He is one of the most successful Indian entrepreneurs in Japan and in the world today. Naturally, he is a leading and respected member of not only Japan's Indian community, but he is also recognized globally for his outstanding achievements both in business and charity. In the year 2010, Mr. Ryuko Hira was conferred the prestigious Pravasi Bharatiya Samman Award by the Government of India. When he is not rubbing shoulders with heads of state at the G8 summit, he is busy attending imperial functions with royalty. Interestingly, Mr. Ryuko Hira was born Kamlesh Punjabi in Jaipur, India. He graduated in gemology from the Gemological Institute of America. As a migrant to Japan, he recognized the need for proficiency in the Japanese language. Soon he completed the Japanese language studies from Sophia University, Tokyo. In the late 1970s, in order to remain competitive in the global travel and tourism industry, Mr. Hira opted for Japanese citizenship with due permission of the Indian government. Currently, he owns and operates over 50 hotels and resorts in Japan and provides management and advisory services to 90 hotels. He also runs many other businesses. Most importantly, he is deeply devoted to Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba and a committed supporter of several projects for the underprivileged in India. He is also the father of two Sathya Sai students. an article published in a prestigious compilation of the world's most influential Indians described him thus, and I quote, "Hira has the characteristics of the 16th century samurai warriors who were powerful yet gentle, strong as well as kind. A samurai is always cautious, careful, prompt and accurate. Hira, with his gigantic multi-operational business empire, remains calm and composed in his actions, equally dedicated to his activities of service to mankind." Unquote. Incidentally, this extremely busy Sai samurai has also authored the book, The Study of Satya Sai. Such a deep and visionary commitment to the Sai mission definitely warrants a Trist conversation for the listening pleasure of Radio Sai Global listeners. And today I'm delighted to welcome Mr. Ryuko Hira to our studios. Sairam, Mr. Ryuko Hira, and a very warm welcome to Radio Sai.
Thank you very much.
I should thank you for accepting our invitation to this interview. So let's start with your journey from Jaipur to Japan that marked the evolution of Kamlesh Punjabi to Ryuko Hira. It's most fascinating, almost movie material. Now, when and under what circumstances does the chapter on Bhagwan Baba enter the story of your life?
Well, it's an old story. I don't have a good memory, but whatever little I can recall, I will place before the listeners. First of all, Sairam to all the listeners from Japan. Perhaps what I say may be already known. The journey to Swami in Japan was established in Kobe in 1975. And in this year of 2015, year after next, we commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Japan Sai Organization. I was in my 20s, and today I'm in my late 60s. So 15,000 days of my life, I have had the privilege of the physical presence of Bhagwan by seeing God, by listening God, and by talking to God, and by directly learning from Him the mantra to be happy. So the story begins with the Lord entering Japan through the city of Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
But what's fascinating is the word Kobe in Japanese language means God's door.
How appropriate.
So the Lord did not come to a megapolis like Tokyo, but through His door, proving to the Japanese that the avatar is the avatar. He came as God through the door. The traditional name Kobe means the door to God. So after sowing the seeds in Kobe, three pioneer Sai devotees, Brother J.T. Kupchandani, and his Chinese spouse, Sister Regina, late Brother Ram Chugani and his wife, Kamla, and the present chairman of the Sai Samiti, Brother Dayal and Sister Huri, they came to Japan to introduce Sai and his teachings. I was approached by Mr. Kupchandani for my social status, and I knew nothing about Sai. And Mr. Kupchandani told me that Baba knows me, and he has asked him specially. So I told him that I have nothing to do with Baba. I do not know him. And frankly, perhaps it was all a trap. So I persistently refused to do anything for the group of Sai coming from Kobe to Tokyo. And also, frankly, I was rather busy in my work. Those were the heydays of the Japanese economy. But nevertheless, this Mr. Kupchandani was very persistent. And he convinced me that his two sons, devotees of Sai, who have been successful in business, Mr. Kishin Kupchandani from Africa and Mr. Nari Kupchandani from Indonesia. And he said, if you listen to me, you will be more successful in business. So I had some interest as a businessman to see. Well, they came to Tokyo and I invited all the Indians in Tokyo. I just said I will only provide a hall and the rest you should take care of. So they displayed the pictures and they gave a talk on Baba and they introduced the books. And for the sake of courtesy, I attended the meeting. And suddenly at the end of the meeting, when the presentation was finished, Mr. Kupchandani stands up and tells the audience that he wants to establish a Tokyo Sai Center. And without asking me, he said, I have appointed Mr. Hira as a convener. Though I objected very much and resisted, it just happened that the Indians started clapping, and out of the blue, I was unwillingly placed into this new and unknown world of Sai. In retrospect, each of my 15,000 days since I knew about Sai have been a fascinating experience, which has been revealing the infinite power of Sai's grace.
Wow. And if I may say, I think Mr. Khupchandani's prophecy that you will have greater business success did play out.
Absolutely, ma'am.
The more you worked for Swami and the more it played out.
Yes.
Now, once Baba entered into the picture, even though you accepted that role so reluctantly to be the convener for Tokyo, how did life change?
Well, frankly, it was a great mess because the change or the transformation, you know, is the only hallmark of a Sai devotee. But perhaps I was a greater sinner, so it took a longer period to change. But my observation is that the transformation of a devotee, you know, varies from a person to person. And for some, there is a very drastic change in their thinking process. Some, there is a lifestyle which is changed. And for some, there's a change of career or family. And some become, you know, very studious scholars of his teachings and so forth. So for each Sai person, there is a different aspect of change. And Sai chooses a special or an appropriate path which is more suitable for the person's upliftment. In my case, a tremendous transformation took place even before my very first darshan. The Kobe Center people, when they opened this Tokyo Sai Center, they said that Sai had sent a message that the old samitis must do the 12-hour bhajan for Shivaratri.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was a great nuisance to inform all the Indians in Tokyo, as there was no email, no fax. The fax system had just begun. And so we had to send a lot of post mail. I sent about 200 invitations for the very first Mahashivaratri in Tokyo, which each was costing about 80 cents. And made all the other preparations. And I knew nothing, so I asked this Khupchandani, and he said, all you have to do is just sing the bhajans till 6 a.m. With a picture of Baba or Shiva. And you should try to fast all night. But I had no picture of Shiva in my house. And only of Satya Sai Baba, which one picture was left by Mr. Khupchandani. Anyway, the day of Shivaratri came. And I had a busy day at office, and I came in time to find that not a single person had come to attend this Mahashivaratri Bhajan in Tokyo. So I thought that they will be late in coming, and I started the prayers and bhajan. But I had never sung a bhajan in my life, and I had some experience of playing a piano, which helped me to play a few keys of the harmonium. But when I started my life's first bhajan on the Shivaratri day, and since no one came to sing, I was all alone singing and reciting continuously the same bhajan over and over again because I knew only one or two from that book. And the voice became rather hoarse and tired, and I was told to sing continuously, so I could not go to the washroom and just stay put. Well, I looked at Sai's picture. And I told him, buddy, I can't do it anymore because I know only these two or three bhajans and we're going to stop it now and I'm going to sleep. So I decided to give up and close this bhajan, and the strange thing happened. There were no push phones in those days, so the dial phones. And the telephone bell rang in my house, and it was about 8 or 10 meters to the place where the telephone was kept. So I had to walk from where I was sitting. As there was no one at home, so I picked up the phone and I just said hello, hello on the phone. But no one answered. And suddenly on the telephone, a very sweet and melodious bhajan begins. It goes on and on and on. And the voice was so captivating that the first time I experienced tears in my eyes, and I cried, and the bhajan was melodious, and at first I kept saying hello, thinking that, you know, it's a wrong number. And because the bhajan was so captivating that my whole body, especially the head, which was exhausted with the singing for a few hours, it was recuperated like an endless tape. That bhajan went on for a long time, maybe 7, 8 minutes or 9 minutes.
Was it a male or a female voice?
Oh, it was a female voice. And it was very melodious.
Do you remember what bhajan it was?
No, madam. If I go into my old books, I intend to write a book before I die. I hope I can. But if I find, I will certainly put that. I'm sure it must be written somewhere. After it stopped, I felt very different. And I restarted the bhajan, this time with more awe rather than an obligation to Mr. Kupchandani. As to who could have called me anyway, I was just awed by it. Anyway, the clock started to show it's 6 a.m. and I was relieved soon that I could now eat breakfast. And I realized that I don't have the picture of Shiva. So how do I finish the ceremony? And again, a strange thing happens just a little before 6 a.m. Now, not the telephone, but the doorbell rings a little before 6 a.m. And a cousin brother called Suresh in Punjabi, he came saying that an Air India flight was stranded or delayed. And he has landed in Tokyo on his way to Osaka, which is southwest of Tokyo. And that he had brought a picture of Shirdi Sai Baba with a lingam and some snake on the picture. So we finished the bhajan and started to eat our breakfast. Of course, I was a non-vegetarian, so my usual breakfast is of eggs or ham, sausages and bacon, whatever it was. But I could not eat that morning. The body just would not accept, although I was very hungry. And the cook which does the breakfast said that you may have lost your appetite because of doing funny things of singing all night and fasting and so forth. So I just took some tea, and after that I began to smoke. I was a heavy smoker, smoking 2 or 3 cigars a day, and I would have about 2 packets of cigarettes. But as soon as I smoked, the tongue started to burn, and again a strange phenomenon took place. At lunch or dinner also, I could not eat meat, or I could not drink alcohol or smoke. And I suddenly realized that overnight that an internal sort of a magical transformation of lifestyle had taken place. And because of my, you know, work, professional work, usually I would eat 2 or 3 dinners in a night with different groups. My assistants would take 3 groups and I would attend each dinner 50, 60 minutes and one of the, you know, very large banquet style dinners. And with 2 or 3 dinners in the same night entertaining high level people, it's impossible to remain a vegetarian in those days. So all this lifestyle in just one night without any pain by itself, all the alcohol, all the tobacco, and all the eating of meat, fish and egg, it just stopped in one night and my whole approach to life had changed completely. This was the very first miracle that my eating and drinking, smoking lifestyle was transformed. And I began to study the first books on Baba. And the first book that I read was Loving God by Brother Kasturi, and other books which made me understand how the Baba respects India as a nation. Because though I was born as an Indian, I had no opportunity to study about India and its glory. And the first book after reading this Loving God, I could respect and serve India as a motherland. So to me, as an overseas Indian, frankly, the first experience was of the lifestyle, and the second in transformation was that belief that I became a true Indian, firmly installed through his summer lectures about the glory and pride of India.
Summer course.
Yeah, and especially that Baba, he has said that India is one of the most exemplary nations of the world, and that's what attracted me to Baba the most.
Hmm. And this, in the process, I believe you did go through a personal dilemma because you had to get yourself a Japanese nationality, and in the process you had to undergo change of name. And again, Baba guided you in the process. Very briefly, would you like to tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. Well, about the change of my name, it was not by my choice, but by necessity. As you know by now that I am the same age as independent free India. And in my primary and high school education, we experienced 3 wars with China and Pakistan. The British rule had not provided enough schools and universities. So even in big cities like Mumbai, where I spent my childhood, the schools were open-air, outdoor schools, to be shared with the street chickens or the street pigs and with the pigeons and dogs coming in and out of the class. And the rains would really drench us all. Life was miserable. And to ease the great difficulties, the Communist Party of India would go to schools. They would offer raincoats. They would offer gumboots. And they would recruit high school students as volunteers for the Communist Party. And in my own personal case, during my middle school, a veteran Hindu Indian actor called Balraj Sahni and others would come to the school on behalf of the Communist Party to recruit students. So India's political situation at that time was rather fragile. And in the high school, they had what they called the NCC, that is the National Cadet Corps. And that was focused for the high school students to join the junior army and to serve 30 days in the camps. And I was fortunate as my family had some small overseas business, which is now nearly 100 years of age. So as soon as I finished high school, the Pakistani and the Chinese wars were going on, and the ladies and the young ones at home were sent abroad for safety. So a decade later, in the 1970s, the situation in India got from bad to worse. That the government of India nationalized all the major businesses, including the banks, the insurance companies, the airlines, and others, to stabilize the nation. And major business houses and their overseas assets were also being nationalized, you see. So being a stateless refugee from Sindh family, where we lost and left everything due to the partition.
Sindh in Pakistan.
Right, right. We did not want to live in poverty again. So my eldest brother said one family member should become a Japanese national to save the family's assets from being nationalized in foreign countries. So being the youngest of five brothers, and I had some fluency in Japanese language, I was asked to become a Japanese. But having intensely read Baba's books and teachings about the supremacy of the motherland, I had great resistance to change my name and to give up my Indian nationality. But due to shortage of time, I can't put the whole story. Perhaps it's somewhere on the Japanese government site. All I recall is that I meditated intensely on Baba, whether I should change my nationality or I should not change my nationality.
On Mount Fuji, I believe.
That's right. So I went to a sacred Mount Fuji, which is incidentally last month declared by the United Nations as a World Heritage, to meditate. And I came back with the answer that a passport document or nationalization or register does not make you an Indian or another national. It is simply a matter of convenience of life. I mean, as Baba said, the true Indian is a person, Bharatiya, who carries the divine values in his heart. So I stuck to that principle, and I recalled the stories of five mothers, motherland being just one, and four others were still with me. So I finally decided to take up the Japanese nationality. But the reason for the change of name is less than 1% of Japanese population speaks English. Before the war, there was 0.1% of people who used to speak English. Because like in France, we're a very nationalistic nation. Mm-hmm. But in 60 years after the war, it went up 10 times from 0.1% to 1%. So when a foreign person has a Japanese nationality, they can't write his names in alphabets because our script is calligraphy-like. When you draw, which if you want to write a river, you just simply draw two banks and a water in between. So it's like kanji. These are pictorial characters is comprised in our script. So if one had to write my name in the Japanese language, it would be very funny if it was literally translated, like Kamalesh means the lotus, and Asia means the king of the lotus, and Punjab, then they have to write five rivers and so forth. So it's a bit too out of place. And the bureaucratic offices, since there were no computers and they can't write in the alphabets, we had to change the name by law. And that was very trying. So there is a Hindu temple on top of the Mount Hira in Shiga Prefecture, which is near to Kyoto, the old capital. And there's a Vishnu temple on top of that mountain. As you know, most of the Indian gods came to Japan with Lord Buddha's teachings about 1800 years ago. So that temple, there was a priest who calculated all the names of my Indian names and ancestral names, and they gave me a name called Hira Duko. Hira is the name of the mountain on which the temple stands. And Duko, Ryu means the dragon, and Ko means tiger. And the word Ryu means the dragon, as you know, has originated in the Indian mythology and then gone to the eastern countries. And Ko, tiger, or the lion, which sits next to Baba, it needs no definition. So the dragon represents prosperity in the eastern culture, and the lion represents, or the tiger represents, the strength, which I don't have both. I don't have prosperity and I don't have strength. So
you're being very modest.
So perhaps that's the name.
And you live up to your name. Now, as an eminent businessman and as a leading hotelier, you're in the thick of the service industry. How has knowing Baba influenced or helped you to get where you are? And has it transformed your business practices and outlook to a more love all, serve all perspective? The 15,000 days that you've been with him?
Well, about the Baba's influence and how it helped me to get or where I wanted to get. Well, my belief is that Baba is the absolute and the ultimate shareholder of our business or of our empire. And every empire in the world, he is the true and ultimate owner or the shareholder. Some people realize that earlier, some realize that later. So the fortunate ones know, and the others have yet to discover. Because Baba is the owner of the business, business itself becomes a sadhana, or the business itself becomes a spiritual exercise. So to discover the divine munificence in business is the real purpose of business. That realization crumbles the ego of the greatest entrepreneur in all ages once she realized that God, Baba, is the doer of all the achievements, which I experienced uncountable times. Whenever I had to make any important decisions, I would physically ask him, and he would guide more as master of my own business, or the owner of my own business, rather than as a God. So,
and all those guidances that you received, they all worked in your favor?
Well, absolutely. I just cannot describe to you a number of times. What is more important is not only the huge amount of profits that he grants, but how he protects you from the losses. One of the most impressive incidents which I physically and personally asked him, in the 1980s early, Japan was very affluent, more than now. And it was aggressively investing in foreign countries. And I have a small business of hotels. And so there was a transaction, or rather well-known throughout the world. It was called property which belonged to the Standard Chartered Bank, located at number 1 Wireless Road. It's a huge property of some 80,000 rai. And the Standard Chartered Bank was acquired by some of the Eastern people. And the bank was experiencing great difficulty, so they wanted to sell the land. And being a bank, they have to sell the land by a public auction. So I was invited in the auction. Our company was invited. The process is rather strict for very large auctions. And I was very emphatic because the land was the prime place just near the Imperial Palace. And one cannot have it again. It's like a very precious piece of land for any development of multi-stories.
Is it in Tokyo?
No, it's in Bangkok.
Bangkok, Thailand. Okay.
Yeah, in Thailand. Mm. It's called Number 1 Wireless Road, was the name of the asset. And we were shortlisted to buy, which means amongst the first 5 people. And we took a team of about 50 people to do the analysis, and we made a bid of $800 million for just the land, because the bank had to be rescued. And after making the bid for that land, we were shortlisted amongst the best 3. So we were invited at the regional head office of the bank in Hong Kong to negotiate the details. And when I had asked Baba that I want to do this transaction, that we will be building 3 huge towers, one was a hotel, one was an office block, and one was a residential block. Each one would be about 100 stories and perhaps one of the most impressive development. And he said, yes, yes, you can do it. So I had great confidence and I was proceeding full steam ahead with taking 50 people from Japan, staying there months doing the analytical work. And we came on the table to negotiate the final terms. But I was asked at that time that the monies should be paid in third countries to save taxes to the King of Thailand. And we couldn't do that because it was a very high-profile public project. So I started to pray to Baba that how come you blessed the project and I'm facing these impediments. Well, anyway, they gave us one day. There are three people by us to make a decision whether you would like to accept the terms of an offshore payment. The reason of offshore payment was because when the Standard Chartered Bank, as you know, Thailand was being ruled by American England, by the Allied forces. So the Standard Chartered Bank was established there for a longer time and the book value of their land was only $1. So if they were to offer the land for sale, the entire amount would go into taxation and the yield to the bank would be rather small. I'm talking this in due respect of morality and ethics to all my friends in the Standard Chartered Bank. It is not to bring the bank's immoral points. So when we came to the decision that we cannot bid this, much to my disappointment, the bidder was another Japanese firm which acquired. And I was very dejected and I thought that Swami's blessings are not the right thing to be asked in business. He is more spiritual and we shouldn't ask him about business things. So this particular person, they did this adharma of paying in the third country of offshore and it was a huge high profile project. All the construction was completed and opened. And after 3.5 years, the promoters were arrested for doing the adharma of the offshore payments. And not only that, 7 years later, which means 10 years when the project started, the property market in that country crashed. So the just land alone was about $700 odd million. And the 300-story buildings combined would be about $2.5 billion. Because of the Japanese boom which had contracted, the crash was so much that the value of all the assets went one-third.
Oh.
So this just shows that how Swami protects without asking. And when he says yes, he says yes in terms of protection, not in the human sense of greed and desire. So there is a firm belief of not to do anything in life without consulting the real owner of the business, which is God himself. So that is one of the experience. But I just want to mention that that just crumbles the ego of the greatest entrepreneur in all ages. You know, one cannot only feel or think that Baba is the owner, but one has to really practice the detachment from wealth and power. So one day...
Is it hard?
Yeah, in the beginning it is hard, but once you become habituated, it is much more easier to put the blame on Baba. Because he knows what he's doing right, and you realize, actually it's not a blame, but it's the greatest blessing. But
the responsibility is his.
Yeah. So one day Baba gave us permission, talking about his influence, to visit the overseas countries to introduce the super speciality hospital projects and later the water projects. So Brother Indulal Shah, the founder of the Satya Sai organization, myself, Dr. Sapphire and Justice Pian Bhagwati, we went to London and we made a presentation at the Wimbledon Theatre about Swami's Seva projects, talking about this detachment and Seva. So, although for the first time in my life I got some kind of a standing ovation for this Baba's talk, it was only due to Swami's grace, but the work was only half done with that talk. The main point of my visit was to bring the awareness of the primary duty of detachment from wealth and for the people there to make contribution to the worthy cause of Swami's projects. But the second half was to actually see the results of the donations to implement these massive projects in those days. And I felt that I had let down Baba from my responsibility of arranging those resources for the divine projects, because all the people, they listened to the talks, but they were not, you know, being detached and sending as much as they should or they could. So I was depressed and I consulted my wife that what shall we do? And I said we should sell our house in Tokyo and do our duty to Bhagawan because he has given us the responsibility to go there and talk. So I took the estimates of the most reputed real estate agent and they said that the minimum price if we could sell our house would be about $20 million. So I flew to Baba and he was most gracious to call me for an interview. I told him, Swami, that I have failed in my duty of putting enough of the resources from other parts of the world and people have not made their contributions. So I have decided to sell my house and we will transfer the money for the divine projects of the hospital or whatever it was. Then Baba looked into my eyes and with the greatest ease, he told me, do not sell your house. Then he said a statement, which in his words, he says, which mother will allow her son to stay in a rented house? So we see here that those who surrender everything to Bhagawan, for them, wealth is only a spiritual tool of divine seva. So also the other lesson of the business being influenced by Baba is that Bhagawan does not want anyone's resources.
How do you say that when all the projects that are run here for humanitarian purposes are fueled and funded by donations from devotees?
Yes, he does not want their donations or he does not want their resources. Mm-hmm. He is only a giver. He never takes. And he said once in the interview room, if Bhagawan wills, there will be a rain of rupees. These are his words. So we see that Baba's main message is complete and absolute detachment has to be learnt and practiced by every businessman by keeping all the financial, human and technical and other resources at the divine lotus feet. When he says, when he takes a project, he does not depend on anybody's donations or anyone's contributions because he knows that what is going to happen and before he takes. But as you know, which is a well-known story most of you must be knowing, he used to talk very frequently to move people to detachment, to sacrifice, to tyaga, for contributing to these various humanitarian projects. One day we were sitting just outside his room and a school student gave him a letter. So he asked the student, may I open this letter and read to everybody? But student was very shy. Swami opened the letter and read, and it is in the formal discourse also. The boy's letter said, O Bhagawan, every day you are giving discourses that people should make contributions of sacrifice and detachment. I am from Calcutta and my mother sends me 100 rupees to pay to the dhobi to wash the clothes in school. However, I cannot donate money because I come from a poor family. I will start washing these clothes by myself and if you can buy one brick with those 100 rupees and put in that, I have done my seva or my duty to listening to Baba. A child has written that. So we see the purpose of Swami informing the projects to people is not at all to collect donations. God never takes, He only gives. He is absolute, you see. So it is only the humanitarian projects are the process to the people of detachment.
Sairam, dear listener, what you just heard was a part of a Tryst with Divinity conversation with Mr. Ryuko Hira from Japan, a long-standing devotee of Bhagwan Baba, and in conversation with him was Sister Karuna Munshi. Dear listener, you could email us your feedback as always to listener@radiosai.org. You could also WhatsApp us to this number, 9393258258. With this, we come to the end of this morning's segment, Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashanthilam. It's me, Sunil, signing off, offering this segment at the Divine Lotus Feet of our dear Lord Sai. At 11:30, Bishu will join you with a segment, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. Thank you for staying tuned, and Jai Sairam.